Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's guest on Better Than I Found It is former Oklahoma State golfer and current swing coach to many PGA Tour professionals, Boyd Summerhays. Boyd is best known for being Tony Finau's coach, as well as Taylor Gooch and Wyndham Clark on the PGA Tour. He's also a devoted husband and a father of three competitive golfers. Boyd gives a master class in how you can be both a parent and a coach and be great at both. He's one of my favorites, and after listening to this interview, you'll understand why. Thanks for listening. Okay, Better Than I Found It listeners, let's give a big welcome to a good friend of mine, former player of mine many, many years ago, Boyd Summerhays, one of the really good guys in professional golf. Boyd, thanks for making the time to, you know, just spend an hour with me here today.
Coach, I was excited when you asked me. You're a good man. I remember the great days we spent together at Oklahoma State, so I'm excited to chat it up.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's been that many years. It's been over 25 years. What has happened? Crazy. Oh,
it does. Time flies.
Yeah, it does. It really does. Well, Boyd, in the world of professional golf, the casual fan might not consider you a household name.
Yeah.
But for those of us in the know, we know better. You know, you've had a big impact on the game of golf in the last several years, obviously, but largely due to working with household names. And one of those is Tony Finau, who we're going to talk about in just a little bit. But, you know, it's like I'd like to start with Boyd Summerhays, the man, the guy I know, the person I know. It's like you come from a really, really, really good family, somebody that, you know, a family I've known for now over 25 years. But you come from a golf family. So it's like there's a lot of golf surrounding you already. So if you could help my listeners kind of figure out this guy who teaches the game so very well today, also played it at a very high level. In fact, I don't know how many people know this, but you were the number one ranked junior player in the country in 1995. I mean, that's a pretty great accomplishment. And you did a lot in the world of amateur golf as well. But who were your big influences in golf early on? And then we'll talk a little bit about some of your familial influences in golf.
My grandfather was the head baseball coach at the University of Utah, but one of his passions was golf. So he ended up being the golf coach as well, even though it was a smaller sport at the time. My dad, Lynn Summerhays, has two brothers, Bruce Summerhays and Gary. My uncle Bruce played on the Champions Tour. He was a club pro until he got on the Champions Tour, a teacher, played some majors because of being in the PGA section in Utah. A lot of people thought that that was me and Daniel, my younger brother, who played 8 years on the PGA Tour. That was our dad. But yep. I'd actually learned the game from my father. My dad played at the University of Utah, where my grandpa was the head baseball coach and the golf coach. And he just loved the game. So I'm one of seven kids. And we grew up at a country club that was way more affordable for my dad than public golf because we had seven kids that were time. So we'd get two foursomes on the weekend. And it was just something that my dad found a way to have his passion of golf, but involve the family. So that's how I got into the game. My parents would take my older siblings to junior golf tournaments, and I was five or six at the time, and they realized, oh, instead of boy just hanging around all day, well, let's throw him in the tournaments. And my mom says that I have always had a golf club in my hands, and I loved the game from the very beginning. I remember playing in tournaments as a kid and loving hanging out with my dad, my siblings. And then on the other side of the family, my uncle Bruce, he had a daughter play on the LPGA Tour, Carrie Roberts Summerhays. At one point, I was on the PGA Tour. My cousin Carrie was on the LPGA. My uncle was on the Champions Tour, and Daniel was on the Corn Ferry Tour. So definitely come from a golfing family, definitely a family disease, illness, passion, a love. All the above. So, and then after an unsuccessful professional career, but getting the PGA Tour and playing the Corn Ferry and doing okay on the mini tours for sure, I stopped playing in 2012 And Preston, my oldest son, he was 9, Grace was 7, and Cam was 3. And that's where I think nowadays I'm definitely known as a coach. I mean, people that grew up playing against me, Charles Howell, David Gossett, Bryce Mulder, Adam Scott, my generation, a player Sergio grew up playing with him. They know that I played and they remember some of the years where I was a good player. But definitely in the last 10 years, I've been recognized as a coach to Tony Finau, Wyndham Clark, Taylor Gooch, and some other guys on the tour. But I noticed a shift in what people identified as my, how they identify with me. Some of it was the Summer Haze name, because people inside of golf recognize that. Then it was wearing all black. Then it was coaching Tony Finau. And then there was a big shift when my kids started to play some good golf. Preston won the United States Junior in 2019 and played at Wingfoot in the US Open. And he's been able to play in 3 tour events and 3 Korn Ferry Tour events. And then Grace came along and became the youngest winner of the Women's State Am in Utah. And Preston as well was the youngest in beat Tony Finau and my brother Daniel's record of being the youngest to win the Utah State Am. And that's when I noticed a shift that I was starting to be known as a dad and a coach to my kids. And before that, it was definitely Tony Finau's coach and wearing black and having the Summer Haze name. So that's a little background on me. And my youngest son now is 15, Cam. And it's been really fun to start the process all over again, where he's hungry to get good and he's not as good as Preston and Grace were at that age. But that is a really exciting thing because he has a little bit of the family blueprint of how to be good. And now that he has the passion for himself, it's been fun to see him grinding on the course and starting to want to beat up on dad on the course and make it a family game. And that's what I loved about growing up in a golfing family is my dad. It really was about family. And then it became a passion for me personally, for my brother Daniel. And now for my kids to see them in the game and have a passion for it, it makes my job even more rewarding just being in the game. And you know that, coach. You've been in the game for how long?
Oh, longer than I care to remember. But I do know this, the example you just gave about it being family, Lynn Summerhays wanted it to be about family first. It just so happens he had some kids who were pretty good, and because they weren't being forced to play, because it was a family activity, they took it and ran with it. And I don't know, I kind of remember that. And I remember I knew who you were, but didn't know you. And I was like a You were a freshman at Oklahoma State in August of 97. I was a freshman assistant coach. I'd been there 2 months. So I was kind of learning right along with you guys. But you had two things that I think are very interesting. You'd already established yourself as a great player. You came in as the best recruiting class in the United States of America. It wasn't even close. And you're getting ready to play for and be coached by the iconic coach, maybe in the history of college golf. And your roommate was pretty iconic for a junior golfer as well, Charles Howell III, who's still playing great today. Talk to me about that time. I remember it quite well, but I've never spoken about that time on the podcast too much. Talk about that. That's a pretty incredible time in your life.
Like you said, me and Charles Howell came in at the same time. I was the number one player in the country junior golf in 1995, and he was in 96. And he was an unbelievable player, AJGA Player of the Year. And we met at Waverly Country Club when we were 14 at the US Junior. We both made a pretty deep run as 14-year-olds. I lost in the round of 16, and he lost in the semifinals or quarters, can't remember. But we had a lot of similarities. We were pretty quiet kids, had strict upbringings or very involved parents in a good way. And so we resonated a lot that way. We didn't party. We liked to work out. We liked to practice. So me and Charles, as a freshman, obviously we'd heard plenty of the stories of Coach Holder. And obviously he was an icon in coaching, but also we just knew the expectation and the tradition at Oklahoma State. And we came in as freshmen. Beau Van Pelt was a senior. Edward Lohr, who also played on the PGA Tour, was a sophomore. And getting there at Oklahoma State, I remember one of the things is we had heard horror stories about Carson Creek. And we show up in the fall, and for some reason, it just wasn't that windy when the first couple of weeks of school passed by. And me and Charles played Carson Creek the first couple of times, and we just thought, I don't know what they're talking about. It's not that hard. We got a 70 and a 71. And then the wind started to pick up in the qualifyings. The greens stayed at 13s, and you could putt them off the greens. And they're really soft greens where if you couldn't control the spin into the wind, they're coming right back off the false fronts. And I knew right from the beginning, I was like, okay, I'm going to become better as a player playing with Bo Van Pelt, who was a first team All-American before he took a year off. And then Edward Lohr ended up being a first team All-American, and Charles, his career speaks for itself. So I just remember getting there, knowing that there was a huge tradition there. And I remember the first meeting we had is he talked to us, and then he gave us a little pencil, and he said, "This pencil, although small, is extremely heavy. You're playing for yourself, but you're playing for your teammates, but you're playing for your university." And that stuck out to me as just the pride that every player has that comes through Oklahoma State. And to this day, even though I didn't play with Ricky Fowler, Alex Noren, Hunter Mahan, Matthew Wolf, and Victor Hovland, there's that bond we all have together that we went through Oklahoma State, we survived, we got better, and we came out the other end better players.
Really did. You just mentioned, I mean, like Bo Van Pelt is still playing today, and he went through a serious injury there for a few years where he was out of the game. But you just named a bunch of players that have just been continually playing well for years and years and years. But Charles Howell III is a really most interesting player because we're going to talk in a minute about instruction because it's obviously involved a big part of your career. Lately in the last 10 years, but Charles is probably the best I've ever seen at handling technique. Somebody just, you just throw a whole bucket of swing technique at him. And before you know it, he's standing on his head hitting perfect striped iron shots. How does he do that? Tell me why Charles is so good at that.
I remember when he came out of college, he had just won the NCAA by a record margin, conference, regionals. He goes and plays a Korn Ferry event as an amateur, takes third, was in contention. He was the most touted college player coming out of school. And in his career, people felt like he should have won a little bit more. The interesting thing is, he did an interview a couple years ago. And he just told the reporter flat out, he goes, "I love to hit golf balls. I love the game." And he, Charles, to me, you had Vijay Singh, you have Alex Noren, that's known as an incredibly hard worker. Charles Howell has played for almost 25 years professionally, and he's never lost his motivation. And one of the things I think that kept him motivated is, like you said, Charles Howell would admit he's had probably the most coaches of any player on the PGA Tour. But in a way, I feel like it kept him interested. It allowed him to have a outlet for his hard work. No one worked, to me, as hard as Charles Howell consistently over a 25-year span. BJ definitely was right up there, and possibly they're just on the same level. But when you do it for that many years and as hard as he worked, he had no off seasons. He loved to practice, so there's no doubt he did have a lot of instruction, and he was used to that. But I think it happened that way because he was fascinated with the game. Most people play for 5, 10 years on the PGA Tour and they're burnt out. They don't love the game the same way. Charles loves the game the same today as he did when he started. And maybe even a little bit more, as Chase, his son, 11 years old or so, is a really, really good player. He's been able to coach his son, and I've seen his swing. And Charles has done a great job of giving him proper technique at a young age. And I agree with you. It didn't matter what swing he used. He just worked so hard and had such a great feel for ball striking. He just hit it amazing. And obviously, he had an incredible career, but people thought he might win a little bit more. But I always thought that I loved his honesty and the fact that he just admitted, I loved hitting golf balls. And maybe the short game and some wedges and some three-quarter shots early in his career never worked hard enough on those. But his career speaks for itself. To go that many years, over 20 years, with never losing his card on the PGA Tour speaks to how damn good he was and how committed he was, how passionate he was. So I've always, I mean, me and Charles are still to this day extremely close, but I have a lot of admiration for him outside of being his friend, just as someone that always handled himself correctly, never did anything wrong in his career, never was in trouble, handled the fans, the sponsors, and his peers in a way that people really were endeared to Charles. I don't really ever hear something bad about Charles.
I don't, and I've got nothing bad to say about him. And I look back on it and I think to myself, he is the ultimate golf nerd. I mean, he's just a golf nerd. And that's not a bad comment. That's actually a
Oh,
compliment. He
I agree.
just loves the game. He just loves it.
Love.
And yeah, I think a lot of players would play a lot better if they loved the game. Some
I
people
see.
are doing it for a paycheck, and Charles never was doing that. He just loved the game.
No, he came from a family where his dad was one of the leading pediatric surgeons in the world. Money was not an issue. He was playing truly for the love and passion of the game. And like I said, to stay that relevant and working that hard just speaks to how much he loves it, loved it, and will continue to love it.
I think you're right. I think he'll play the Champions Tour loving it, but he'll be watching Chase hit those golf balls. I think he'll definitely be doing that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Tony Finau. He's one of my favorite players for a lot of reasons. One, he's easy to relate to because he's just a good dude. So you know, I know you've known him. I remember you telling him, Mike Holder, about him and Gipper
Yeah.
probably when they were 13 or 14 years of age. So we knew about him a long time ago. But so what makes him an elite player? What are his best qualities? I know he's a great husband, father, great guy, great friend. He's got all that going for him, but that's not always the case for a world-class golfer. But what makes him elite? He's really an elite player. Why is he elite?
I remember hearing about the Finaus coming up when they're about, like you said, 13, 14, even 12. Tony won the junior worlds at age 12. So that's when I started to hear about, hey, these Finaus just smash the ball. Big Polynesian kids just kill it. And we got to play a couple of events together on the mini tours, a couple state opens. And I remember playing a Korn Ferry event together, not in the same group, but in the same event. And it was in Utah, Willow Creek. And there was a big fence, a big net at the end of the range. And I knew he hit it far. So I wanted to see it. I had never seen him play. I'd heard a ton about him because Utah's a very small population. Most of the population is in the northern part, which is, an hour drive north to south in that concentrated population. So we knew who he was for sure, but I'd never seen him hit a golf ball. And when I saw it for the first time, I could not believe how easy it looked, but how far it. And he ended up making, I believe, the cut that week. His brother made the cut. He was the youngest player to ever make a cut on the Korn Ferry Tour at the time. He was 15. But that's how Tony got into the game. But quickly, Tony got to a level where he turned pro at 17 because of this mini tour opportunity where the winner, the big stakes, would win $2 million if they won. But if you got to the final 12 after 2 days, you had to turn pro. And so, coming from humble beginnings, he decided to turn pro to have the chance of the 2 million. Scott Piercy ended up winning the 2 million, but I think Tony ended up winning $150,000. He turned pro, and he played on the mini tours for 7 years. He made the Korn Ferry Tour in 2013, got through the Q School. His first year on the Korn Ferry is 2014. And he gave me a call a couple of months into his Korn Ferry season and wanted to get together. I thought it quite possibly could just be talking to me, wondering what the tour was like, some suggestions. But deep down, I was hoping that he was coming to get a lesson. Very interesting is before we met, he asked me a question. He said, "Boyd, are you done playing?" And I said, "Yes." Just a one-word answer, yes. And from there, when he showed up at it's a Muni that I teach in Utah, Davis Park, he showed up in basketball shorts, basketball shoes, and a t-shirt and a hat backwards. And I'm like, "This guy's my guy." And so he, at the time, he was, spinning the ball a little bit too much, curving it left to right a little bit too much. But when I saw him hit and I saw his demeanor, and he was known as having great hands around the greens as well, great athlete, great basketball player in high school, even though there was some technical things that could improve, within a month, I told him, I said, Tony, you can become a top 10 player in the world. And anybody that can be top 10 in the world can become number one. And he talks a lot about that still, 10, almost 9 years later, that at that time, being on the mini tours for 6, 7 years can be a little bit, it can chip away at the confidence a little bit. He said that meant a lot to him, that before the fact that he became that type of player, I felt that strongly about him, but it was just his presence. And people know that presence now. It's quiet humility, it's quiet confidence. He's way more confident than he gives off. You don't have to be arrogant and talk about yourself to be supremely confident. I knew he had the personal confidence, and then if he could get the skill sets a little sharper with his size, his athleticism, how high he could hit the ball, but it was how flush he hit it. Yeah, it was spinning a little bit too much and it was curving a little bit too much, but I had never heard or seen somebody hit it so flush than Tony. And that's where the combination of his size, his power, how well he struck the back of the ball and had good hands around the greens. I just saw that with very little instruction, he worked with some guys right out of when he turned pro. When he signed with Callaway, Callaway had him go to some high-profile guys at the time, and it just didn't work out. It wasn't the coaching's fault. It wasn't Tony's fault. It just didn't work out. So Tony went about 3 years without instruction, 4 years, until he reached out to me. And the thing that I was impressed with the most is, like you said, is just who he was as a person, kind to everyone, patient with people. Just really, you could see that he had a higher purpose in life. I felt that from you when you were a freshman coach, I was a freshman player, is that it's always been more than golf to you. It's been about developing young men. It's about your faith. It's about making a mark in this world, leaving it a better place. And Tony, I sensed that right off the bat. And I think we formed that bond early on with some success, but also just the way we were as people off the course and the way we like to treat people. And when they did this Netflix series on Tony, a lot of people, they already liked him. They already were drawn to him because of how he'd handled himself through 5 years of some really close calls, some bitter losses. And he always handled losses with class and grace. And so when he started winning, he was even a bigger superstar. People already loved him before. And then when they did this Netflix series that really got behind the scenes about him as a person, his wife losing her father, and him stepping up and saying, okay, to support Elena, but for me to still have my career, I'm going to take the family every single week. He has five kids. That is not easy on the road. It's very taxing, but he embraced it and he loved it. And a lot of times, certain players have a reputation on tour as being a great guy, when really we know them better than that, and they're all right. And there's some guys that have an image of being a jerk that actually are better guys than their perception is. But with Tony, when they did that Netflix series, I was like, wow, they actually captured Tony Finau, the person, the husband, the friend, the dad, and the golfer. And sometimes it just seems too good to be true when someone is that nice of a guy. But with Tony, it's just the truth. So I think he makes an effort to make people feel good, the way he smiles, looks at people, talks to people. He's not too big for anybody. And that's why I really respect him, is that as he continued to get better, he never changed. And I take that, I attribute that a lot to his humble beginnings. Comes from a very faith-based family, very committed parents. And he came from a really tough part of town in Utah. And so he appreciates everything. And I think because it took him so long to get to the Korn Ferry Tour, he's never lost that appreciation for how lucky he is to be on the PGA Tour. Some guys forget really quick that it's a blessing. Even a bad year on the PGA Tour is an incredible life and opportunity. And he's just never lost that gratitude or that sense of incredible opportunity he has.
Two things that really struck me with what you just said when you were describing why Tony is elite. You can be elite and be a good person. I think a lot of people think you have to separate the two, but it's part and parcel who he is. He's just a good person, and he's a great player, and he's a great person at the same time. You can do both. And then the other thing is his self-belief grew with one simple statement you gave him that you didn't know was that impactful until
Right.
later. Well, that's what coaching is about. And you're a coach. What people People don't realize this at all, but you're a teacher and you're a coach. Because, and I'm gonna let's move to that part of it as well, because if teaching the game of golf includes swing technique, it does. Strategy and playing the game, it does. Short game for sure. And by the way, you have the most underrated, never talked about hands in the history of the game.
I had to, coach. I was in the shit all the time. I
I
was
know you
the
were, but my goodness, boy, did your hands create some great shots. And then life skills and mentoring. So all of that's included in it. Maybe it's a little different for a young, rookie than it would be for a veteran, but the life skills and mentoring, talk about how you interweave that into your teaching.
I think you explained it really well. There's a difference between teaching and coaching. I taught my kids how to play golf. My dad taught me and Daniel how to play golf, and he coached us at the same time. The coaching piece was every day we were playing games, competitions, playing something where every day we had a putt to either win, lose, or to close the gap in a match. My dad knew how to practice, taught us how to be effective. That's coaching. Teaching is the technical side. I think one of the bonds that me and Tony ended up having is that I had taught tour pros at home before that, but I had never traveled on the road and asked to get out on the road. So we both, he came off the Korn Ferry Tour and I came off the Korn Ferry Tour as well with him, and that bond together. So there was more teaching at the beginning, but then it becomes about every player has their DNA and you want to keep them on track, not fall back into their old tendencies. That's some teaching, but a lot of coaching. And then when Tony was a rookie, I think the coaching aspect or the mentoring aspect, the comfort, he asked me to caddy for him the first few events on the PGA Tour because he had a really high golf IQ. He said, "Boyd, if I can just get comfortable on the PGA Tour, I'm going to do just fine." So he wanted me to come out there and caddy at the beginning, along with the coaching during the week, just so he could get comfortable. And so coaching has a lot of hats, like you mentioned, and you've co coached way longer than me and have a lot more experience on managing different personalities, knowing when to say things, not to say things. That's a part of good coaching. Is teaching is just simply the technical side to me. It's just, okay, this is what we need to do to hit this shot, or this is your weakness in your swing, and you keep that in check. But coaching goes into scheduling, goes into managing the off course things, the on course, knowing when your player something is bothering them and it has nothing to do with golf. You know all those kind of things about a player as you are around somebody, and you learn to get the coaching is getting the best out of your player, basically, in my opinion. And that's been the fun part of being a golf instructor slash coach. I definitely view myself as a coach, not just a teacher. I think that's why certain players have come to see me, because they knew I was successful as a junior and an amateur. They knew I briefly played on the tour, and they would trust a little bit more of the coaching and instruction aspect because it was a holistic approach, short game, mental, swing, not just being on the lesson tee. And all the players that I've been hired by, they've wanted me to watch holes, not just sit on the range. And that was always my philosophy, is I'd never went out to every event. It was usually on the West Coast, I'd go to some days of every event, and then after that, it was every other week about, because I don't even believe in someone being on the range with somebody every week. That's not the reality of getting to know your game, learning how to play with what you've got. And so I believe that certain players ended up seeing me because of the coaching aspect and knowing, being well versed in different aspects of the game, but also just knowing what it was like to be a player. I learned a lot from the successes and I learned a ton from the failures I made as a player. And that's where I think it made me a pretty good coach. I never, ever, ever imagined being a coach. I always imagined playing a long time on the PGA Tour, winning on the PGA Tour, being successful. I was number one in the country at one point. So you can imagine the big dreams I imagined accomplishing as a player. And I did it. And I made a lot of mistakes. And when I got injured on the tour, I kind of was a little vulnerable, believed that it was my technique, when in reality, bought a motorhome with my young wife and Preston, being a 1-year-old, and we just drove all over the country, and I probably didn't stretch out as much. I unfortunately became a coach, not because of injuries alone. It was because that I made a lot of mistakes as a player. bounced around instructors. My head started to spin. I'd be on the range all day instead of some on the range, and then a lot on the short game wedges. And it kicked me off the tour pretty quick and got me into being a coach. And it was fascinating. Once I was done playing, I was like, oh my goodness, my whole playing career led me to be a coach. The success and the failures and being in the game my whole life. And I couldn't imagine it any other way now. I love what I do even more than what I did before. It allowed me to be home enough to still coach my kids. And when I taught my students growing up, they always just called me coach. It was either Boyd or coach. It wasn't Mr. Summerhays. I said, you call me Boydo, Boyd, or coach. And so you're right. There's a difference in teaching and coaching. And coaching has a lot about getting the best out of your players, motivating them, knowing when to say something, not to say something, and just helping them reach their potential.
Okay, well said. Great explanation. So, and I know you have more than just one golfing child, but I would do want to talk about Preston because I was there at Inverness, and we got to see each other. I haven't seen you much through the years, but I got to see you there, and I'm just going to ask you, what did that? I know you're not, as an interviewer, you're not supposed to ask what did it feel like, but how hard was your heart beating when he was trying to win a US Junior, something you weren't able to do and you wanted to do desperately. And here you're watching your son do this on a great, great golf course, by the way. And he's playing a great, great opponent, Bo Jenn. I mean, the guys can play now, still an All-American at Oklahoma State. So describe that week real briefly, if you could.
So Preston, one of my dad's philosophies was if you couldn't dominate the people in your own backyard, why go to the next level? So I didn't play a lot of national events except the ones I qualified for, US Junior, Junior Worlds. Max Fly PGA was huge at the time, the Big I, Insurance Big I. I didn't play my first AJGA event until I was 16. Well, Preston, same thing. Once he started to win the junior golf tournaments at age 11 and 12, I just put him up there in the 13 to 14. New challenge, kind of get beat up, then take the next step, become the best player in the 13 to 14 as a 12-year-old, and same thing. Move him up to the 15 to 18 division once he was the best, 13, 14-year-old by far. And his breakthrough for him was when he won the Utah State Amateur as a 15-year-old. He beat Kyler Dunkel, who was ended up playing, some really good professional golf. And he was giving up literally 80 yards to him. He swung at 103 miles an hour at that age, and Kyler Dunkel swung at almost 130. When he won that, I think that gave him a ton of confidence. He had taken two-thirds in the junior worlds before that. But when he won his second state amateur, he had the US Junior. We took a red eye the night after, or that night, gets done with his match, finished, thank goodness, pretty, with about six, seven holes to go to where we could get to Inverness to play the practice round. And he was riding high off some confidence, great match play player. And that was his first really big national event besides Junior World and a couple others. And Akshay Bhatia was the favorite. And he was getting interviewed with Michael Thorbjornsson. And they said, hey, is there a sleeper pick? And Akshay said, Preston Summerhays. No one really knew who he was, honestly. The people locally did for sure, but nationally, no. And as he got through match play pretty easily, he ended up making an incredible run in the US Junior. He beat Akshay on the last hole. He beat Michael Brennan. He beat Austin Greiser, and he beat Bo Jenn. When he looks back on that run he made, he'll be really proud of that. But you can imagine me as a father, never won in the US Junior, but seeing your kid play is a totally different thing. People ask me all the time, and I think the answer is instinctive, but who do you get more nervous watching? Tony Finau, Taylor Gooch, Wyndham Clark, or the tour pros or your kids? And even though, yes, it's your job, and if you don't have success with a player, you can get fired, you get hired to get fired, nothing is like watching your kids play because you've invested your life, or at least me and my wife did, into our kids' development as people. And then I was also their coach. So when I'm watching my kid go through this run on a course like Inverness, which is one of the greatest courses I've ever been on. He wins the first couple of matches, and I knew he was playing great coming off his win at the State Am. And you kind of see him, okay, this is shaping up. He ran when he ran through the first couple matches and then beat Akshay. I was like, okay, he knows, he's a very confident kid already, but it started lining up where there was a real possibility. And a lot of those matches, he came from behind. Greaser had him 3 up with 8 holes to go. Bo Jin was a couple up after the first 18. And I remember my wife wasn't there, Grace wasn't there, Cam wasn't there. And at the time, I pretty much filmed all the shots so I could send them to our family. And I remember when he hit the shot on number 17, he did not swing hard as a kid. And then all of a sudden, when he got to 16, we kind of realized, okay, we got to start doing some speed training and whatnot. And he was never a great scramble player, an escape shot artist, because he hit it so darn straight as a kid. He didn't have to scramble very much. So he gets in the left rough trying to go down another fairway on 17 because he played it down the fairway on 17 every day and was bogeying every day. So we're like, okay, let's go down the other fairway. And he made a birdie in the morning session with Bo Jim, but he ended up blocking it, going down the left side into the right rough of number 16, but the left of 17. And he has this massive tree to go over. And like I said, if he wouldn't have done the speed training, there's no way you could get it over that tree and through the rough. And you can see on slow-mo, he literally, his feet are off the ground at impact. And for someone that had no escape game, his greatest shot I've ever seen was that shot. And I remember being on the phone live with Barbara Jean. And when he hit the shot, I said, that was the greatest shot I'd ever seen him play. And it
Wow.
rolled up to the hole to 8 feet. And he knocks it in to beat Bo Jin. And it was almost like a surreal moment. And then you see the picture on the green where I have my hands on his cheeks. And that was a dad moment. That wasn't a coach moment. That was just a supremely proud dad of a son. So yeah, the US Junior for me, that's a memory that I'll always have, that I was there with him all week, saw every shot of every stroke play and the match play. And I'll never forget that, nor will he. And I think that gave him the confidence moving forward to where when he did have some lulls in his game, you've seen that. He's had some great progression and then he's kind of stalled out for a little bit, works through it. I think that gave him the confidence that, hey, I'm good at golf and I can do this.
He's good at golf, but he's also good in big moments a lot of times. I mean, just last month we were playing in Arizona State's tournament and he made, I don't know how far the putt was, 12 or so feet to win the team title for the Sun Devils. So he's good in big moments.
Yeah, he is.
By the way, how could you, being an absolute supreme escape artist, how could you not teach him that?
I mean, that's on me, coach, isn't it? It's just
That
so
really is.
just hit it so straight. And I was actually known as, hitting it crooked and being able to make a score. If I had a swing, I had a shot. And it was just ironic that I was, and because of that, though, I was more picky with their technique at a young age because I felt like my goal was, by the age of 15, 16, I wanted a swing that was good enough. Obviously, you'd be trying to improve things as the years go by, and he has, and Grace has, and Cam has. But that was my lesson from the tour, is that I played with a little bit of an open face. And so I always fought the right shot and then occasionally left because it felt like it was going to go right. And so thank goodness that Preston did work on the technique, and we didn't do a ton of speed training. I knew that distance was important. My dad was my uncle's coach, and my uncle hit it short. And my dad literally put him in a 48 inch driver that was legal at the time. And they did speed training, speed training, speed training. I knew it was important in the game, but I also could tell Preston was going to be big. He was going to be tall. So I thought, okay, let's get the technique right. So then when the speed training comes, he still hits it straight. And so, yeah, I'm glad that at the time he wasn't a good escape artist.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, but he probably has gleaned a little bit of that from you, whether he likes it or
Oh,
not.
for
He's
sure.
got some of it in there.
Oh, there's
You
no doubt.
mentioned Barbara Jean earlier, and I remember Barbara Jean when you were a freshman, you were dating, but when you came back from your mission trip 2 years later, you guys were married,
Yeah.
and you live in a really poor looking apartment on the west side of campus over there in Stillwater. I poor Barbara Jean, what? She must have been thinking, what am I doing?
The first
Has she
time
gotten
she'd
over
really,
that?
yeah, that was the first time she'd been out of the state for more than a couple of days. She was a dancer in high school and college, so she performed in California and Florida one time each. And so going that far across the country, being away from family, being very young when we were married, that was a real challenge. There's no doubt about it. And it was a different world. Like I said, we lived on the part of town that wasn't the most posh, and she's out there with no friends and family, and I did work hard, and so there was a lot of times where I wouldn't get home till dark or a little past dark. It was about a 12, 13-minute drive from Stillwater, or Carson Creek, back down to, downtown Stillwater where we lived. And she had us some she got introduced to like what it is like to be married to someone in the game of golf. And I give her a lot of credit for putting up with me and the kids. I mean, she didn't really know what she was. She knew I was a player for sure, but we talk about it now. She would have never imagined that not only was I going to be in the game and coaching, but now she has three kids that travel and do it and work hard at it. And so she's definitely a golf mom, and she's done a heck of a job. But her personality, and you know this, she's just the sweetest person, the most kind,
She is. She
peacemaker,
is.
and that's reflected in the kids a lot too.
Well, I wanted to mention Barbara Jean because you kind of did there for a second, but it was like your wives. I mean, Pam, she's put up with so much with me. With, I travel, I recruit, I do this, I go that, and she's been amazing with it. So our wives, they make us better. There's no doubt. So you are a golf dad. You're an instructor, you're a coach. So you do travel, like you mentioned earlier. How do you juggle your family life, being a husband, being a father, being and traveling? And you travel with the kids to tournaments, but you also are traveling with the tour, to meet a tour player. How do you juggle that and do well at all of those?
I'm really honest with the tour players I end up working with. I tell them that my kids, even Tony knows this, that I will do my job with him and I will work extremely hard. I've never been sick in the 9 years that I've worked with him, always showed up, put my, heart and soul into my job. But all the players I took on, I said, okay, this is how it's going to be. Let's see if it's a fit. And I'm very honest with them that I will not put my job over my kids to where I can't be there enough for them to be able to help them on their journey in golf, but more importantly, just be there as a dad, because when I'm gone, and that's one of the reasons why I never did go each week. To some people, that is what works for them, but I knew early on that wasn't going to work for me to be happy. You've been coaching for so long because you are happy, you love what you're doing. You can't do what you've done for that long if you don't love it. And I knew that I would love being in the game as long as I still had time with my kids. And so, on average, over the last 10 years since I've taught, I've been at a golf course 355 days a year. That's the average. We take two vacations where we go away from golf and don't do anything. But now that life's gotten busier, that's turned into 1 week. And the weeks that I'm not coaching, I'm watching my kids play. Tomorrow morning, I've been working with Cam today and some other clients, and then Grace this afternoon a little bit. And then I'm gonna go fly down at 5:10 in the morning, go watch Preston play 36 holes for the Pac-12, fly back and be with Cam and Grace and my other clients on Saturday. And it's just that I just want them to know that I'm gonna watch them play or train them as a coach, but just be there to watch them play as a dad. And I think that's what has been fun for me, is that and it's been hard. You have to differentiate. Number one is dad. Then I am really close with my kids, so a friend, and then a coach. And it's been a challenge. I've learned, I've made mistakes, and the only rule that I have with them is that when I make a mistake, and I will just say sorry, and I'll say specifically why I'm sorry and what I did wrong. And that's always fostered trust in between me and the kids, is that people will, a lot of times, I appreciate them saying, you've done a great job coaching your kids. But I tell them, my kids have done a hell of a job being coached by me. It's not easy to listen to a parent. And so I give them a lot of credit for managing a difficult situation for them. It is not easy to listen to a parent. And so it's been a mutual thing where I respect and admire my kids for continuing to listen. But as they've gotten to be better players, there's an art to that. I've taken the good things my dad did and maybe a couple of things that could have been a little bit better. And I understand as they get older, rightfully so, I want them to become more independent. I want them to be stubborn. I look at stubbornness as a quality, a trait of successful people. So I want my kids, the better they get, to challenge or to ask questions and be in charge of their game. So now, Preston and Grace, for sure, they run the ship. I am their coach. And if I coach on the PGA Tour, I wait for the player to say after a round, hey, what did you see out there? Oh, this is what I was feeling. And then we started the conversation from there. As Preston and Grace have gotten better, that's how it goes. After a round, they bring up what they want to talk about. And if there is nothing to talk about, there isn't. And so managing it is that I do feel like as long as they know that it's dad first. And to me, dad first is just time. Kids want time. They don't need the nice clothes. They don't need the things that success can bring. They just want your time and attention. And now I'm grateful that I live in a generation of technology where now Preston and Grace and Cam could be playing in three different states at one time. I'll be with one of them, and then my wife's sending me swings of or the shots, the play-by-play of one of the kids, and then I got a buddy that travels with either Preston or Cam in the summer. Then I'm connected through them as well, and you do FaceTime lessons. When we're all in town, we do the lessons in person, but just time. That's how it works. It ends up working for the kids and me.
Well said. You know, if you're teaching at my age, which is 63, you're 43, correct? Yep. So in 20 years, if you're still teaching, can you picture yourself teaching Preston on the PGA Tour?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, as
Good.
long as I treat him with respect and treat him as he is my boss, and then off the course, I'm his dad and his friend, then it works. One, if I step over that where I act like I run the show, no, I put my coaching cap on, and I made a lot of mistakes when I first taught because I was trying to give them as much instruction, and I wasn't just teaching one-on-one. Once Grace started to play, then I've got two at a time, and then three at a time when Cam got going. And I had to learn, oh my gosh, I actually need to give one-on-one lessons, and then we'll all play together. But I had to think mentally, hey, coach them exactly like they're a paying client. And I think one of the attributes I had that I think was good in coaching is I never showed frustration. That's one of the key things to learning is golf's already a hard game. I assume I'm going to give my best, and I assume they're going to give their best, and they're paying me. Why would I get frustrated and impatient with them? I should just explain it better. If it doesn't make sense to them, I need to do a better job coaching. And when I made that correlation and really could do that day to day, I'd say 3, 4 years ago, I got pretty good at putting coach cap and then taking coach cap off and going to dad. But at the first, it was really hard. I had to clarify with Preston. When we get into talking about golf and coaching, it'd be like, okay, as a dad, I couldn't be more proud of you. I'm not talking to you as a dad. You can't make me more proud. He is a good kid. Grace is a good, fine young woman, and Cam is a great young man. And so once I was able to clarify for them, hey, I'm just talking as a coach. We're just discussing this as a coach. And if you want to be the best player in the world, which my two oldest have said they want to be, you should want to be coached hard, intense. You want to know the truth. Great, great, great players, they want to know the truth. They don't need a yes man. They don't need a cheerleader. They need encouragement for sure and belief from the people that support them and their team. But my kids have allowed me to coach them tough. And as a parent, just time and love, time and love. And then it worked to be a demanding coach or organized, strict, and let them know the truth. And I think that's how it's worked for us.
You know, in the modern day, there's more and more fathers actually continuing to coach their sons. I mean, Jim Furyk was kind of one of those. Justin Thomas, his dad, Mike, is his teacher. Cam Young's dad, David, is his teacher. Yeah, so I like that. You know, my dad was the only teacher I ever had, and I wasn't a great player. Played mini tour golf, and so, but I always remember having a conversation with my dad. He was my teacher, and he was my dad both. So I watched him take that coaching hat off and you know, become a dad. And then he was a coach. And the greatest lesson I ever learned about responsibility, I learned from my dad's coaching hat. I mean, he told me how the cow ate the cabbage, and it was real. So I love that about you, Boyd, that you can do both. And but if Preston decides 5 years from now he wants to be an accountant, I think you're gonna love Preston just as
Oh, for
much
sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah,
But
he
he
knows.
knows. Yeah. He knows that. Okay. All good stuff. Great parenting advice. Great coaching advice. You should be a college golf coach, but we couldn't pay you enough. So you're going to have to keep doing what you're doing. But I do have one final thing I want to get from you that I've been trying to get from some college coaches. So
Yeah.
I asked a college coach, you know, if you've been coaching 25 years, tell me a hybrid player, if you could put the best of all the players you've ever seen together, make a superstar hybrid player. So I'm asking you to do it in the years you played, but also the years you've coached. The best driver of the golf ball, the best approach player or iron player, best short game, best putter, and best middle game. So I'll go one at a time with him. So I know that that's kind of throwing you on the defense here. Who's the best driver of the golf ball that you've seen personally with your own eyes that you would love to put in this hybrid golfer?
Rory and DJ in a tie.
Okay, I
Yeah,
totally agree that
for
it'd be hard
sure.
to argue
Who
that.
I that's who I'd want to hit a tee ball for me is Rory when he's hot, DJ day in and day out. It's incredible how good of a driver of the ball he is.
Iron play.
Tiger Woods.
Thank you. I was hoping you'd say Tiger because that's the one I've
Yeah.
never seen a better iron player ever in
It's
history.
it's incredible.
He doesn't. He didn't miss an iron long and left, like pull it and it goes 20 yards over the green. Everything finished on the number like Ben Hogan did, but he was hitting it further than Ben Hogan.
Yeah, by far Tiger.
Short game. You can't say yourself, even though I believe you're the best short game player I've seen, but go ahead.
Chipping, pitching, bunkers.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to say Jordan Spieth, and the reason why I say that is sometimes statistics lie a little bit. When I think of Tiger Woods, incredible putter. He was making putts to win tournaments, to win majors. His stats were under the fire. Jordan's short game shots are under the fire. I take Jordan Spieth. My brother played with him. Daniel played with him in that the Byron Nelson when he was 16 years old. And I said, "Did you see it?" And he didn't quite see it because at the time he was more of a technical player, and Jordan didn't have a pretty golf swing. But he did say, he said his short game was four level already at 16, and I'll go with Jordan.
Well, I can't argue that one. I did recruit him very, very hard to try to get him to come to Oklahoma State, and that short game, it wowed you every day. Putting, just pure best putter that you've got to put in this hybrid golfer. I'm okay if it's somebody you've already said, by the way.
Yeah, I would if I had a putt for some to save my life, save my kid's life, I'd give Tiger the putter.
I don't think he ever missed an important putt. Not that I
No,
saw.
but no.
No. All right. Middle game. Best middle game of any player that you just like this guy's got to be included in this hybrid golfer.
Tiger. I know
Wow.
that's a lot of Tigers, but he's done it for ever since. You talk about being famous at a young age and having the expectations. You hear the Curtis Strange interview where he laughs at him for saying that all he wants to do is win, and you'll find out that, second and third are pretty darn good. Tiger's been under the microscope the whole time, and I think we're starting to see when he won the tour championship. That was the great, I believe, one of the greatest comebacks in all of sports. He went through the chipping issues. He went through personal issues. He lost his game completely. He lost his body, his health, and the will that he has is incredible. And I think that's a part of being mentally tough. Obviously, he got trained by his dad, a Green Beret, and his sports psychologist, Jay Brunza, was in the Navy. He had high-level mental training. And I think that's why you ended up seeing, I wasn't in the generation of Jack Nicklaus or other players like that, but Tiger, he was the most skilled. And he was the most mentally tough. And I think that's what resulted in winning four majors in a row. You think of how good DJ is, Rory, all these players, Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth, Tiger won four majors in a row. That's incredible. And so his will and his self-confidence and determination, we're seeing it when he won the Masters. Not only did he win the tour championship, but somehow he wins a major 8 years later than his latter. He didn't win since 2008. He wins in 2019. And the way he did it, you could see it wasn't one of those things where, hey, I haven't been there, I haven't won one in a while. There's a little shred of doubt. It was just like Tiger. People knew when he got it over the water in the middle of the green on 12, we kind of all knew what was going to happen. And then when he hit it close on 16, that was just kind of like, okay, that's Tiger Woods.
And you know, if I still say a healthy Tiger Woods would win tomorrow, he just
Yeah.
hasn't been healthy in the longest time. He could still win again. And I know that every man's, you know, skills will deteriorate at some point, and maybe Tiger's never going to win again. But I'm not surprised you would put Tiger in three of those categories, because he's really the greatest player who's ever played.
Well, and I say that because, like Jordan Spieth, one of the years where he was making all those 20 and 25 footers, where he was double the make percentage of everybody else, he still had issues with short putts. Tiger went years, multiple seasons on the tour without missing from 5 feet and in. People don't understand that. That was when we weren't tapping spike marks. He's playing Pebble Beach and he didn't miss inside 8 feet. And those greens are so slow, so bumpy. That's why I say Tiger on the putting is that he literally his he was not only just a great lag putter, he didn't three putt much, but he was incredible from 8 feet and in. And par putts. He talks about it. His par save putting was incredible.
Well, not you, you, everything you said is completely true, and remembering he had more pressure putts than any other player other than maybe Jack Nicklaus in history. And he actually made more of those pressure putts than Jack did. So I agree with your hybrid golfer. I think the guy would win every week if you had that guy. But anyway, so
Well,
boy,
I only say that like I give the credit to the guys. So my brother was a top 10 putter on tour over the 8 years. Well, his putts weren't necessarily win tournaments. These stats that Tiger and Jordan on these short game shots, they're doing it under pressure. You can't underestimate that because a lot of people would say, okay, Aaron Baddeley was one of the most famous players for being a great putter. Incredible putter, but he won a few times on tour for sure. But I think if you actually equated or gave value to the situational makes, it's Tiger Woods.
yeah, you're right. I agree with that. Very, very well done there. But boy, this has been a blast for me. I actually learned a lot about you today. I didn't know. And it was really good to hear your perspective on being a dad and being a coach and morphing the two together and taking one hat off and putting another on. Really, really healthy to hear that. Really wonderful to hear it. But I'm watching Preston play two or three times a year now at tournaments, and I missed you at Arizona State last month. I was about 250 yards from you, and you came over and said hello to my players. I appreciate you doing that.
Course.
And I look forward to seeing you the next time I'm at a tournament you're at.
Well, I appreciate it, Coach. And one thing I will say is that when you took over the head coaching job at Oklahoma State, I don't think many people could have imagined the success you had. They go to the match play, but how many times did you win stroke play, right? And other
A few there.
things. But it wasn't about that, Coach. You developed players. When I think of the best coaches, there's different classifications. I try to look at things objectively. There's people that were coaches that were great recruiters, great fundraisers that gave them the reputation of the best coaching because they have the best players. You developed players that were pretty decent players, but you helped those players get better. The thoroughbreds were going to be thoroughbreds, but I could always tell you love because of where you came from. You're a blue collar guy that had to work his butt off to have the success you had. And I always noticed that about you, Coach, is that you wanted to help the players that needed the development. And I always loved that about you, the way you kept in touch with the alum after we were gone. That said everything about you, Coach, that even after we couldn't do really anything for you, never asked for a dollar, but you still cared about us. And if we wanted to donate, we would. But the fact is that once you coach somebody, that's the true measure of a coach, that you're always bonded to that coach. And so I appreciate you, Coach. Love you, Coach. Respect what you are as a person, a coach, and for how long you've done it.
Well, I appreciate that, boy. Love you too, and really appreciate you spending an hour with me. This was great. Great trip down memory lane, but also I learned a lot about you, which is great. So, best of luck as you continue to go forward. And when I see you at the next tournament, I'm going to come up and give you a big hug.
Thanks, Coach. Appreciate you. Thanks for having me on.